Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. It's the Monday after Super Sunday, and I guess we're going to buck the trend a little bit here at FX Guide. And instead of concentrating on the commercials of the Super Bowl, which I think is well covered elsewhere on the net, we're going to bring you a really interesting story, and it involves the show Attila the Hun. They'll be airing in the UK on the BBC coming up on February 13th. And that's directed by Gareth Edwards. And what's interesting about this is the fact that Edwards effectively did these shots himself over a period of 5 months by locking himself in his house and using off-the-shelf software, things like Adobe After Effects, using the dynamic link capability in Premiere to easily allow him to see all the shots in context and so forth, Mocha AE and as well as 3ds Max and other tools. Now, I personally don't feel that the big, really high-quality visual effects houses or post-production houses for commercials are going anywhere. I think there's a real need for that, this bringing together of creative talent at a high level and being able to execute the effects quickly and easily. But what it does point out is that in certain situations, it really does bring the ability for creative individuals such as Edwards to do projects like this and effectively set up shop as a one-man band. And I think you're going to find the conversation he had with Mike Seymour to be really interesting. So I guess without further ado, why don't we go ahead and join that conversation now. Mike Seymour speaking with Gareth Edwards.
Well, thanks for that, John. Gareth, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So it's a remarkable project, and I'm dead keen to get your point of view on it, but or rather to highlight your involvement on it. But maybe you could give us some of the background on Attila the Hun.
Well, Attila the Hun is a one-off TV show for the BBC. It was commissioned as part of a series called Warriors. They've changed the title in the UK to Heroes and Villains, but I think it's still called Warriors in the States. And it was made by the BBC and the Discovery Channel. It's kind of one of those, what they call factual dramas. And each episode was supposed to cover a different warrior in history. So we've got like Napoleon, Attila the Hun, Spartacus, Richard the Lionheart, Cortez, and Shogun. And my particular episode was Attila.
Now, the show itself is what? Is it an hour or 2 hours? How long is the actual?
Yeah, it's just an hour. It's made by the factual department, but it's actually technically a drama. It's all, you know, the usual thing of actors, and there's a bit of narration, but it's by one of the characters in the film.
So in your 1 hour, how many visual effects shots have you got?
I did a count the other day, and it's roughly around about 260.
It's an astonishing number of shots. So,
yeah.
So now, normally I would say, how big was your team on this, and how many people did you have working on it? And
on the actual digital effects?
Yes.
At the end. For the actual post, actually creating them, it was just me.
Which I think is just incredible. And so when I was first aware of the project, I started looking at it. And, of course, I assumed that these large battle sequences, that which I had the press photos for, were massive and done with massive software. But, in fact, let's start with the battle sequences, because how did you do the battles?
Well, I guess every shot sort of had a different approach, but I think I know the ones you're talking about. And there were two types of approaches. There's one that was for the charge across the battlefield.
Yep.
And then there was one for the main end battle, which is where they're all on the top of this hill sort of thrashing it out. And there's supposed to be between 30,000 and 250,000 people fighting, apparently. They still don't know the numbers. There's an argument going on as to how many there actually were.
Well, I'm referring particularly to the shot high looking out across the grass with the forest behind. And there's
people running across.
Huge army of, looks like, as you say, thousands of people. So tell us how you did that, because I already know, and it's incredibly amazing.
Oh, thanks. Well, no, basically that was like a poor man's process, really. It wasn't, I mean, obviously when you're trying to do 260 shots in what ended up being close to 5 months, you're doing like having to do more than a day. So there were certain approaches. There was just a way I was going to be able to do. So I kind of ruled massive out any sort of 3D crowd system. You know, there was no way I was going to get my head around that in time to make it work. But what I would do as a trick is, because you only have such a short amount of time to make an effect shot work, is I'd take films like Lord of the Rings or Kingdom of Heaven, and I'd watch particular shots on loop. And even though I knew it wasn't true, I'd try and convince myself that those guys had done it in a day. And I'd sit and watch them. And initially you'd sort of think, oh, there's no way, you couldn't ever do that in a day. And then slowly you sort of go, well, actually, you know, if you painted, if that siege tower was just a painting, and if those guys at the background, I can hardly see them move, they could be a painting. And you slowly break it down, and by the end of it, you kind of think, actually, you know what, if I'm really crude and, you know, it's just held together with sellotape and things, I could probably pull something off that emulates that. But it won't obviously be as good, and you couldn't watch it over and over, and you start to spot the flaws. But for the first viewing, you'd probably get away with it. And for that shot you're on about, I was watching all the sort of Lord of the Rings type shots that do the same thing. And with the exception of the shots where they sort of the camera comes round and looks back on itself, some of them you sort of watch it and think, well, this could just be little, I don't know what you'd call it, but baseball card sort of flat polygons that have green screen footage of people running on. So the whole approach basically was that it's a particle system, and I happen to use 3ds Max, but I guess you could do it in any software. And it's a particle system where the particles are just following basic terrain, going up and down, and on those particles are just flat images of some guys against green screen just looped who are running across the green screen. And so what you end up with, I think there were seven guys, and if you light it a certain way, they stop looking like the same seven, and you kind of, it looks like, I think there's 3,000 or 6,000, I can't remember the number. For that shot.
Let's recap that, because I think you dropped out just for 1 second there. 250 okay. shots, you're working at a rate of two shots a day, and you get seven guys, you've got to turn into thousands. I mean, you know, you'd assume that you had at least, you know, several hundred that you could clone the groups on, but seriously, seven?
Yeah, honestly, that shot that you're talking about is seven guys, because, I mean, we didn't have the world's biggest... we had some stunt guys when we were filming, and the last day of the shoot, we basically had, we built a green screen in Bulgaria. The whole thing basically was shot over 3 weeks in Bulgaria, because the whole of the campaign that we were talking about that happened in the past, where Attila went through Eastern Europe, actually went through Bulgaria, so it was the right geography. It was also a lot cheaper than filming in the UK, and they had some backlot studio sets that were Roman. And so what we did is, one of the first things I did, because my background is visual effects, is I kind of took, you know, tried to talk them into taking some of the money from the art department and building a giant green screen, because I'd obviously seen it used successfully in films like 300 and Lord of the Rings and stuff. And I thought, this is the only way we're going to be able to pull this off at the scale we need to do. And so as part of that process, there was one moment where, I mean, I had two of my friends come out during the shoot. His name's Luke Wilmot and Tony Gilbert. They got a company over here called Shadow Industries. And they came out basically and worked as a second unit during the actual shoots and just blitzed loads of elements of green screen material. So, for instance, we'd give them four guys a day, and those guys would have to change their outfits, and they would do things on treadmill. They would do fake little generic battle moves. And so what I ended up with was loads and loads of material at the end that was just little guys fighting against green screen or running or whatever it was. And in that particular shot that you're talking about, it was footage of... We tried doing the treadmill thing where you have people on treadmill running on the spot, and then you use that footage to create a battle charge. But I found that it's something weird happens with your center of gravity when you're on a treadmill, and you don't seem to run correctly. And when you make someone who's run on a treadmill move along the screen, it just looks odd. It looks like they're doing a very light jog, and no matter how much you try, it just looks fake. And so at the last minute, we kind of grabbed the stunt guys again and just very quickly said, right, just sprint across the green screen. And so they sprinted across, and then we filmed them on a long lens. And so you can imagine, they just for one loop of their run cycle, they kind of make it across the whole green screen. And then I stabilized that footage later, keyed it out. So then I had these little loopable guys, and they did it seven times. So there's seven different guys ran across, and it honestly was just seven. And then, so then once I've got those little guys with their alpha channel, I would then attach them to the the particles within Max. I was using a particle flow, which is a bit more sophisticated than the other one they used to have, and I attached them to the little particles, and so you can offset the timing so that when it takes the footage of the stuntman running, it can randomize which frame it grabs, which sort of helps make them look like there's more than one guy. And then also on top of that, I would do a pass where I would randomize the brightness of each guy so that that would then result. And it's quite interesting because it does trick. I mean, if you sat and watched it over and over, you'd quite clearly see, oh, that's the same guy as that guy, and that's the same guy as that guy. But for the brief moment it's on the screen, you know, in the context of television, you kind of get away with it, I feel. And, I mean, basically it was the only way I think I could possibly have done it. And there's even a crane move on the shot, but the whole of the shot itself is just one big Photoshop painting. It's not a real crane move. It was painted using some footage from a helicopter over fields. And then that was mapped onto like a cove, a fake sort of 3D cove in the computer. And it was all done as separate passes. So I did like a pass, which was the guys running just with their diffuse channel, sort of running across the terrain and undulating up and down over the terrain. And I did a pass, which was the same terrain, but with my Photoshop painting over the top. And what I found was crucial with that is not to light it at all. I tried sort of making grass within the computer, and I tried putting some little trees and things in there. And every time I did this, it just looked fake. And so in the end, what I did is I basically did like a matte painting, if you want to call it that, of from the angle of the jib move, and projected that without any lighting, just 100% self-illuminated onto the polygons. And then your brain kind of is desperately trying to interpret it, and therefore sort of helps you kind of believe that it's really in 3D space. But if you actually watched it, it's incredibly crude. And then I had to obviously do passes. I did an occlusion pass. So there was little like occlusion areas around the guys that were running, and that really helped it. And then like a shadow pass, and then even clouds over the top, casting shadows, so it'd break up, so you'd have patches of light and dark, and just every trick in the book, and then just composite the whole thing together. And I was quite relieved, because it was one of the hardest things I knew I had to do in the show, and when I could see it was going to work, it was a big relief. But it really is a poor man's massive. It's not that cleverly done. It's just purely like...
Oh, no, I'm going to stop you there. To say it's not that cleverly done, it's not fair. And look... The thing is, you were coming at this, obviously, being a very experienced visual effects. I mean, you've been nominated for Emmys and won BAFTAs and stuff. So you're used to working in visual effects and presumably in much larger teams, right?
Yeah, I mean, early on in my career, I mean, my first job ever at this was just on my own at a production company doing, like, title sequences and doing sort of visual effects for little things they needed. It was very low budget. TV channel. And then I got offered a job at a company called 422 in Bristol, who did a lot of stuff that was science orientated for Discovery and the BBC. And that's how I got to know ultimately the people that I'm working for on Attila. But I kind of only really worked within a company for about a year of my career, and I've mostly been freelance and just working from home, because I just find on the budget level I'm dealing with, it's nearly impossible to do this stuff to the level that I'd like when you've got all the overheads of a big team and an office and everything. I did start a company. I had a company for about 6 months, and within the first month, I decided it was a really bad idea. I just couldn't get enough good people that would work as hard as they would need to work for as little as they would earn. To make stuff really good for TV, and I didn't, you know, I don't blame anyone either, because I wouldn't do it if it was someone else's company. And so I just packed that in and carried on, basically been working from home pretty much for the last 5 years or so.
Now, it's a remarkable effort, and you really weren't. I mean, it's not like you've bought a couple of flames and have them at home, right? I mean, this is basically a setup with using After Effects and Photoshop.
Yeah, it's all pretty much Adobe stuff. I've got my workflow basically is it was kind of didn't work as smoothly as I'm going to make it sound, but we were in the edit, and when you're sort of directing and you're in the edit suite with the editor, whose name was Colin, who was brilliant, basically you sit there and you make a request or you have a discussion about what you want to do with the shots, and then there's a lot of downtime where you just sit and twiddle your thumbs, and it takes a few minutes for the editor to flip shots around and try things out. And what was great for me was that in that downtime I had my laptop. So the process in the edit was that we'd talk about changes in the sequences, and then during the downtime I would sit and do pre-visualizations of every shot that was missing in the film. And so over the period of, it was a 6-week edit, over the period of 6 weeks, by the end of that edit, I had pretty much very, very, very crudely blocked out really rough sort of animatics, or whatever you want to call them, of each shot that was missing, so that we could picture lock at the end, and the executives and everyone that had to sign it off could roughly see what was going to be delivered. The downside was, as part of that process, we started out with, the plan was to do no more than 100 visual effects. And by the time we pitch a lot, because you hit problems, you go, oh, don't worry, we'll computer generate that. Oh, we'll do that in the computer. By the end, it was like 250. But then what happened is... Then what happened is, once we were picture locked, it was shot in that sort of pseudo high def, the 720 version. And I got a copy of the whole film at high definition, so they auto-conformed the show. And I had my own copy that I had on a timeline within Premiere, and that had all the crude audio mix, everything. So essentially, it was like looking at the whole film. You know, you could sit and watch it in high def on my high def telly at home. And so what I would do then is, for every shot, I would take the plates, or whatever it was, if it was green screen element or whatever it was, there was something representing it in the timeline. So in the morning I'd get up, I'd export that as, say, a QuickTime, and I had 8 hours or hold all day to try and make that shot. And so then basically it'd be exporting it into a tracking software. The first thing I'd do is track it. So it'd be like...
What were you tracking in?
I was really lucky because we shot our film with Pro 35s, which, for anyone who doesn't know, is a way of using the look of 35mm film on a video camera. The downside of that is that you get a very, well, the upside of that is you get a very narrow depth of field, because it makes things look more cinematic and beautiful. But the downside from a visual effects point of view is that, say, I'm filming a guy in front of me, his background is usually pretty soft and it looks beautiful, but then the problem is there's nothing to track. And I was quite panicky about this, because I knew that at the time that we were filming, I had nothing that at my price level that I could afford to track this stuff. But then Mocha came out, which I can't remember the price, I don't want to get it wrong, but I think it's less than a grand or something, but it was within the sort of price I could afford for software. And that basically was brilliant, because you could just isolate an area that was all completely out of focus and draw a line, you know, little shape around that area. And it would track the whole shot and export it into After Effects. So once I'd tracked the shot, I'd put it into After Effects. And then really crudely, like speed painting, I would try and create the world's crappiest version of that shot within about half an hour. So say it's a shot where you're having a conversation with someone and behind you I'm supposed to put a castle. What I would do is really roughly just sketch in Photoshop a really rough version of where the castle might go and what kind of perspective it should be and things like that, and which bits dark, which bits light. And then I would then create a composition really crudely, and I'd basically set up, if you imagine, like a little pipeline where, because Adobe all talks to itself, so what you can do is you can create a composition in After Effects, render it out, put that back in the timeline in Premiere, watch it in as part of the whole film, and then have that on loop. And then I would make a list, it sounds really weird, but I'd make a list of, in priority order, of all the things I want to do that shot to make it look more real. And then I'd go back into Photoshop, do a few of them, hit the render buttons again, and automatically it would update on my timeline, and I could watch it in the context of the film. Because that's the trick, I think, is that there's no way you can do that amount of work, you know, to the level that is perfect to watch a million times over. But the key was to get it to work so you could watch it kind of within the flow and the context of the story, because I found in the past that you can do visual effects and you can break your back trying to make something look great, and then or something's not quite working, but as soon as you put the sound effects in, or the music, or it's within the context of the story, or you've got the previous shot before and after, it can totally make your shot, or it can totally ruin your shot. It just depends on where how it's going to work. For instance, we were doing some shots as part of this film. There was a shot where there's a lot of Siege Tower stuff, and I think it's really crude what I've done, but there was one particular shot that I'd done where the Siege Towers were coming past the camera, and my executive producer said, oh, can it move more? Can it rattle a bit? And can it shake? And I was like, yeah, it can, you know, but it's going to take me maybe a day to set that up, and I just haven't got another day, and, you know, what can we do? And there was this big kind of pressure to kind of redo a whole bunch of shots because the Siege Towers weren't rattling and moving and, like, shaking a lot. And so we just added the sound of creaking wood and rattling, and they watched it again and were like, great, that's it, that's fixed. And you hadn't changed it at all. It was just the sound effect had saved the graphic. And so I think it's really important when I'm doing visual effects, to always use sound effects and always see it as closely as it will be in the final film when you're judging it through the process of making it, because otherwise you kind of get obsessed with areas that ultimately won't be important. And for instance, your eye might, on the previous shot, your eye might be looking at an actor that's on the left because he's talking. And when it cuts quickly to your shot, because you know your eye is on the left, that's where you're going to randomly pick to start looking at the next shot. So that's where you need to put your detail. And things like that. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that happen when something's suddenly put in context. But, I mean, that was crucial to the whole thing. And also, I think the other fundamental thing was working backwards from the end point. Like when you make a film, what happens is if someone was to be able to time travel and before you start your film, if they would be able to take the final film that you end up making and give it to you before you even begin and you could watch it, you'd do loads of things differently because you'd say, okay, we wouldn't shoot in that area because we never actually used that scene and we wouldn't spend all that time on that actor because we cut all those lines out and things like that.
Sure.
But with digital effects, you can work like that. So what I would do is, within the first half hour, is do the world's, you know, most rubbish version of the shot I possibly could do really quickly. And then once you see it, you go, ah, you know what? That guy with the really crude rotoscoping, he blocks the whole side of that castle for the whole of that shot. So I didn't even have to paint that, you know. And you start realizing there's a lot of effort that you would have put into it.
Well, now, see, there's an advantage there for you because you weren't doing it in an environment where you had to sort of cover your ass and know that somebody may come back later and suddenly decide that they're going to, you know, want to see all that side, right? I mean, you're basically
definitely,
saying that you
yeah,
had a lock early that really counted.
Definitely. That is, I mean, obviously, in a weird way, you're kind of your own boss, but you're not ultimately because the executive producers control everything, really. But it is a case of they knew what we were up against and they weren't going to ask ridiculous requests like, can we suddenly have a shot over here when it was never part of the plan? And so, yeah, you do know exactly, and you know you're not going to give yourself, you're going to try not, you know, you're not going to be schizophrenic about it and give yourself a hard time. You're just going to make,
but now there's, try and make the there's, most. There's one other thing, though, that, I mean, that's all very, very good points. But I think the other thing that you may be selling yourself slightly short on is just having a good eye for what's going to make it to sell a shot. So let me just ask you this. There are simple shots where you've clearly done a sort of relatively modest amount in the background, but it's all about your eye and your ability to do the right amount of work to sell a shot. Now, there's a couple of shots of some Roman soldiers, for example. This isn't one of the, you know, hero god shots of the army, but these two guys have clearly in foreground, the background's going to be out of focus, and you've just put enough of the Roman army in behind to sell the shot, a couple of flags and stuff. But that's a subtle job to keep it that muted back, to not have it too contrasty, to not have it the blacks too black, and to grade that in so that it completely sells the army behind them, but just isn't that dramatic. And I mean, that's a, you know, a balancing job. I'm just sort of wondering how you went about grading them and how you went about keeping that sort of moderate control over the composition.
Yeah, I mean, I know the shot you're on about. Thanks for saying that. But that's what happened with most of these shots is that it all grows from the wide shot, the establishing shot, and then you're kind of locked into the environment that you've set up for the audience. And for instance, in the scene that I think you're talking about, there was a big, it starts off with a shot behind the Roman general, and we wanted to show this big, massive army just going out in front of him as he's kind of contemplating what he's going to do next. And then he addresses his other soldiers and briefs them on what they're going to do for the attack. And the shot you're on about, I think it's one of the soldiers listening to the briefing. And the problem is once you set up in a wide shot, all these elements, all these, like, thousands of people kind of marching along, then the problem is every time I have a cutaway or even the guy giving the briefing, you've got to keep these guys walking past constantly. So, for instance, with that shot, it's more a case of I'd already have the element created for the wide shot. So I'd have kind of a render of a bunch of Romans kind of walking across from left to right, and they'd all be stacked up, and it'd be like they'd have their own alpha channel, so it'd be like a drag and drop thing, really. And I would drag it and drop it into the back of a shot like that and do some crude rotoscoping, and then it's just a matter of playing with, I mean, pretty much all I do is just blur it until it's the right amount of blur, go in and play with the levels until they look kind of like they're sitting in the right place, and then also kind of position the thing left and right, up, down, etc., and just move it around until it kind of feels like, well, that seems like a nice composition.
But you, I mean, you're normally on a project like this have a DI, but you didn't have a DI in this. Like, you're doing the rotoscoping and the DI grading all in After Effects, right?
Yeah, but at the end of the whole process, we did have a grade. So once I'm grading to, like, the ungraded stuff, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
And then once I finished all the visual effects, the idea is they then sit down with a proper grader, and he grades the whole film as if it's, you know, irrelevant of whether it's a graphic or rushes.
I mean, there were some quite detailed roto shots. It was just done in After Effects. You didn't use any specialist roto tools?
No, I mean, I wish someone would invent an automatic rotoscoping something or other. It would make my life, I'd have a social life maybe, but it's all just really tedious After Effects, you know. Like, to be honest, when it comes to a bit of rotoscoping, I leave it till last because I'll do a very crude version, and I'll always leave it to last because typically it will tell you, the crude version will tell you where you need to place other objects and things like that. And then what I do is at the end of the day, I think, right, okay, this looks like about 2 hours of rotoscoping, and I just put a film on that I like, and I just kind of, it's really like donkey work, but you just sit there and push and pull keyframes and splines and just try and get through it without going insane. It's just part of the job, you know, you just kind of, you've got to do a bit of roto. There's no sort of shortcuts. I mean, you can key little bits, and I always try and key before I roto. Like, I'll key whatever I can, like, if it's someone's eyelashes or something, I'll use a sort of levels key on the dark areas and stuff. But if it's the skin, I'll do everything I possibly can to not have to roto. And then at the last minute, it's like, right, I got away with these bits, but not these bits, and those are the bits I'll go in and fix.
So let me just walk you through the timeline. You were shooting in Bulgaria for, what, 3 weeks, and then you went into offline, I think you said earlier, for about six, is that right? 6 weeks?
Yeah. And during that process, like I was saying, I did the animatics or the pre-visualizations for the shots as well as the editing. My editor, Colin, did the editing. And then what we did was, the goal was always to only have, I had 3 months of post time. Once the picture was locked, once we'd finished the offline, I then had been allocated 3 months to do all the visual effects. And my rule of thumb is you can't do more than a shot a day. And so with 3 months, that was roughly 90 shots. And so that was always the plan. But whilst we were editing and whilst we were filming, you know, compromise sets in, and you don't want to compromise. So you end up saying, look, don't worry, we'll do it in the computer. And by the end of the edit, it was up to 250-odd shots. And so it was, like, quite clear I wasn't going to get it done in 3 months. So they extended, they gave me another two. So I kind of had close to 5 months. And then it was just a matter of sitting down for 5 months and not seeing any of my friends and going slowly insane and just trying to go through one shot at a time and get it all done.
And that culminates all on this Wednesday, the 13th of February, on BBC One?
Yeah. It's going to go out. We just found out the other day that it's going to go out at 9 o'clock on BBC One on the 13th of Wednesday. But obviously the Discovery Channel are going to show it as well in America. But I have no idea when that will be.
So you're looking forward to sitting down and watching it off air, or is it going to be like I can't stand to look at it another minute?
Well, we're having a screening on Monday, which is like a big deal screening, a chance to sort of meet everyone again that worked on it, and just sort of, you know, an excuse for a drink, really. But for the actual time, I can't watch my films when they go out. I find it really, it's really depressing, because it's kind of like seeing an ex-girlfriend or something, or it's like something you just want to avoid. It's so much pain there. That when it's suddenly played on a TV and it's reduced to a little box in the corner of someone's room and people aren't paying it full attention, and it kind of, I don't know, I don't enjoy that. So I tend to kind of go out and just ignore it. And you might get, I get a text off my mum at the end saying, I saw your name on the credits, well done. And I know that it's finished. It's kind of, it's awkward.
Well, look, I can't thank you enough for taking time to talk to us. We really do appreciate it, and for providing the really great before and afters that we've got on the main site. Are we allowed to ask what you're up to now? Are you just recovering, or are you already on to the next project?
I've got nothing concrete in the pipeline now. I'm just trying to get the next thing sort of set up, really. I'm just
which begs the question, how can people get in touch with you if they're interested? If you have a website they can get to?
Yeah, no, if someone... Definitely. If they get in touch with you, I'd love to speak to people about.
Okay. Well, if they want to get in touch with you, we'll get them to email me, and then I'll filter the Attila the Hun Nuts out and send the rest on to you. But we really do appreciate you taking time talking to us. Thank you so much.
That's great. Thank you very much. Thank you. It's been great.
Well, thanks, Gareth, for taking the time to speak with us. And once again, I found this really interesting. And in my opinion, it still comes down to the creative talent of the individual. If you look at Edwards, he won a BAFTA award in 2006 for the best visual effects in the Hiroshima TV show. He's been nominated in past years for other BAFTAs and Emmys. And again, it's this idea of technology and so forth enabling creative individuals to get this kind of process done. I think the conversation was really interesting. We also have a cool breakdown of shots that he put together for us, a QuickTime movie download at the header of the article, as well as some before and after pictures, as well as imagery on the FX Guide site. So if you haven't checked that out, be sure to drop by fxguide.com and read the print article that accompanies this podcast. Well, that's it for this week. Once again, we'd love to hear from you guys in the forums or an email about story ideas for Effects Guide, as well as just your reaction to articles and so forth. Again, it's the feedback that really makes this worthwhile for us, and we appreciate all the emails that we get from you guys. So for my co-founders and business partners, Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, I'm Joe Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.